Now, I apologize to the audience for the change of venue and welcome you to hear Mr. George Papandreou speak on politics as education. The minister is a distinguished alumnus of the school, gaining his MSc in sociology in 1977. He was until recently Minister for Education, where he showed a particular interest in developing the open university idea in Greece. Following the recent Greek general election, he was appointed alternate Minister for Foreign Affairs. He is MP for Athens District A, where he was returned with the highest number of votes of any elected MP. He's a member of the Executive Committee of the Pan-Hellenic Socialist Movement, PASOK, and he is to speak to us now on politics as education. Minister.
Thank you very much. I felt honored when this summer I was asked to give a speech at the London School of Economics. Being an alumnus, also being here at a time when you're opening up the Hellenic Observatory. At the time, the party I belonged to, PASOK, was learning to live without its founder, Andreas Papandreou, who was my father. A party headed by a charismatic figure for over 20 years needed now to learn, as we say, to stand on its own two feet. This very much was a growing experience, and it may have inspired me to choose the title for the speech, Politics as Education. But certainly not only this. Indeed, the experience of Greece over the past 22 years, that is the span of time since the downfall of the fascist junta, has been a period of both learning and deepening of democratic institutions. It has been an experience not unlike many of the Latin American countries which have had to emerge from military dictatorship, or the Eastern Bloc countries which during the Cold War were subjected to different forms of authoritarian rule. I remember when we were negotiating with the European Commission in the early 1980s, funding could be given to us for vocational training. Specific industrial vocations would be the target. Beyond vocational training for a highly industrialized Europe, I felt that we needed the support for broader forms of education. Greece faced the challenge of creating a democratic culture, which would allow it to move ahead. In particular, how could we talk about countering unemployment of women, for example, when very many of them in the countryside didn't dare leave the house? How could we talk about specific vocational training programs for farmers when they had little skill in cooperating with each other on production processes, pesticides, volume of produce, standardization and marketing of the product? How could one train family industry when they had little desire to employ others or skilled labor outside their family or merge with others in order to create a more competitive unit of production or distribution? Collective work, trust, democratic practices, social skills, as they are now called, were as important in any developmental process. As I said, Greece faced the challenge of creating a democratic culture. Authoritarian and centralized government, on the one hand, plus clientelism and the absence of meritocracy, on the other, had created a citizen who was passive, lacking initiative and imagination, frustrated. He was, however, active in securing favors from the state apparatus. This enhanced a vicious circle of dependency on the state machinery and a zero-sum game which bred deep mistrust with his or her neighbors, fellow citizens, in competing to secure favors. We note, indeed, a distressing lack of trust at many levels of the system. This is one of the comments the OECD assessment team has recently made, even now, concerning our educational system. This vicious circle further undermine the development of civic society, democratic practices. Over the years, this clientelistic and authoritarian relationship between the politician and the voter was in essence a corrupt relationship. Therefore, building democracy was and is a constant process of education. The experience of shaking off authoritarianism is no easy process. The adoption of laws or decrees, the creation of legal institutions of democracy or meritocracy, is necessary but never adequate. Democracy is not something which can simply be legislated and certainly not imposed from above. Michael Oakeshott, in his inaugural address at LSE, spoke of political education. He said, "The hungry and the helpless, the hungry and the helpless man is mistaken if he supposes that he overcomes the crisis by means of a tin opener. If in order to meet crisis, there were some steady, unchanging, independent guide to which a society might resort, it would no doubt be well advised to do so. But no such guide exists. Political crisis always appears within a tradition of political activity, and salvation confirms the unimpaired resources of the tradition itself." John Dewey could have agreed with Oakeshott. "For to get rid of," he wrote, "the habit of thinking of democracy as something institutional and external, and to acquire the habit of treating it as a way of personal life, is to realize that democracy is a moral ideal. It is to realize that democracy is a reality only as it is indeed a commonplace of living." So moving beyond authoritarianism not only refers to democratic institution building, but equally, if not at times, even more so, to a process, an educational one, of attitude change. Democracy is not a sum of mechanical processes. It is a whole culture of symbols, meanings, understandings, trust, and common identifications with basic underlying values, which allow for the more crude mechanics of parliamentary democracy to work. If this culture were to be destroyed, or if it were non-existent, no democracy could survive. Social scientists such as Robert Putnam, in several disciplines, have recently suggested a novel term to explain these underlying values, i.e., that is, of social capital. By analogy with notions of physical capital and human capital, tools and training that enhance individual productivity, social capital refers to features of social organization such as networks, norms, and trust that facilitate coordination and cooperation for mutual benefit. Lawrence Harrison, in a provocative and Weberian way, has attempted to define the cultural values that shape economic and political success. He mentions four factors. First of all, the radius of trust or the sense of community in a society. Secondly, the rigor of the ethical system. Thirdly, the way power authority is exercised within a society. And fourthly, attitudes towards work, innovation, saving, and profit. Both these authors paint bleak pictures of the future of societies which have little social capital. But while Harrison points to this democratic social capital deficit in countries such as Thailand and Philippines or the Latin American countries, Putnam makes a point to warn of the state of politics in more traditionally democratic societies. Our political parties, once intimately coupled to the capillaries of community life, he states, have become evanescent confections of pollsters and media consultants and independent political entrepreneurs, the very antithesis of social capital. And he continues, "We must nourish grassroots organization." How does one create this social capital? The Greek experience, although not unique, may be seen to many as irrelevant within their context. I would like to support that the more stark colors of democracy building in countries like Greece can illuminate the more subtle but nonetheless existent problems that today's democracies face in Europe and other parts of the world. While much was done and has been done in Greece to reform and change and move towards democracy. We are already facing, as other societies and other countries are facing, a post-industrial, knowledge-based society. And in this society, there are new problems and new complexities. Whether it is the complexity of today's problems, unemployment, internationalization of the market, environmental problems, media, technology, or whatever, whether it is the old forms of social and political organizations which seem to lack the necessary ideological tools to interpret the events, whether it is new interest groups that are being developed, whether it is the media demystification of the politician, or a lack of a Cold War enemy, all this has created a deep crisis of confidence towards our political system, towards our democratic institutions. This is compounded by the insecurity, as I believe, of today's politicians who attempt to hold onto a more traditional role of a politician, that is, of a person who has all the answers and all the solutions. And this crisis could further be could further undermine the trust and the credibility of our institutions and politicians, particularly when new problems are faced and when deep insecurity and anxiety is created, possibly something like the mad cow disease. Finally, cynicism or even exasperation on the part of the citizen that does not feel that he or she is part and is participating in events and in decisions can further complicate the crisis as populism, racism, fundamentalism, etc., become seemingly relevant reactions to the crisis. We've seen this in many of the former Eastern European countries, and particularly in former Yugoslavia. So we do need to regain a sense of confidence, both for Europe and for our democratic societies. I personally believe that we need an educational approach to this new reality. Our parties, our traditional political institutions, must reorganize around a new purpose. I can speak, of course, for my party or for more progressive parties. I can't speak for all political spectrums. But I do believe that while party platforms are still useful in creating a point of reference and focusing on the goal ahead, much of the importance that lays ahead of us is in fact an educative aspect of these political institutions. That is, we need to put greater emphasis on the process and less emphasis on the party programs and the party goals. Or maybe put it in a different wording, the quality of the means we use in order to reach our goals will determine the quality of the outcome of our final objective. So I believe that modern political parties in this new post-industrial age should become primarily educational institutions. What do I mean by this? I mean that there should be a concerted effort to change the roles and relationship between the politician and the citizen, where the citizen is expected and helped to participate in politics, in political issues, much more actively. This in turn redefines the role of the politician first and foremost. The politician could be more an animator, an animateur, a catalyst for change, leading the inquiry as an educator, rather than a magician holding up a populist magic wand. In fact, what this prototype of politician is characterized by is his or her ability to be self-critical, to learn, to engage in constructive dialogue, to assume responsibility for positions, take a stance when necessary, but at the same time, consistently hand over responsibility to the citizen, learn from him or her in an attempt to help in collective problem solving, bring out underlying conflicts and contradictions rather than hide them, but use these contradictions as a tool for learning and not for polarization. Certainly this image of a politician educator has little to do with Plato's aristi, or aristocracy, and has much more to do with Aristotle's useful citizen who knows both to govern and to be governed. As he says, the virtue is to know both sides of the coin. The goal is a deepening of democratic participation, an empowerment of the citizen, an extension of the democratization process to new areas of society and new pockets of power, whether this be media, the internet, environment, or production. I truly believe that if we are not able, through a similar process, to engage the citizen of our time, to inspire towards politics, to create the necessary space for participation, to help him or her self-manage problems through developing his or her knowledge, we will soon see our democratic institutions decay into atrophy, lost amidst violence. How can this be done? Ron Heifetz, in his work Towards a Learning Society, Leadership and Authority, says that developing a robust adaptation to a new challenge is, in a sense, a learning process. He continues to develop this theme as an important process on how to orchestrate adaptive work among conflicting, competing perspectives. What is important in his work is the way he sees conflict. He says, engage the perspectives of those that challenge you. Conflict and heterogeneity are resources of social learning. He uses an example of the Cold War, where he sees that traditional politics sees conflict more as a standoff between two sides or a number of sides. But in the end, this standoff is really an avoidance of real learning of how to solve a problem, a social problem. Cold War, the example he uses, was the example is Reagan's Star Wars, which in fact was a solution which was no solution to the real problems in the Cold War. On the other hand, the need to understand a problem and learn about a problem was exemplified in the type of problem we met as Europeans in Bosnia. And only when we became more engaged in the problem and learned about the deeper roots of the problem could we approach and find some semblance of solution to that issue. Another educator, Paulo Freire, well known for his pedagogy of the oppressed, also agrees and says that conflict is the midwife of consciousness. Let's take the example that Samuel Huntington uses. He says that we're up for a cultural conflict or cultural clash. Clash of cultures is what he sees in the world. Well, why cannot we see through a new educative process that, for example, Christianity and Muslims can meet in a dialogue rather than a cultural clash and use this difference as a dialectical educational process to learn from each other? That does not mean that there won't be clashes and there won't be differences, but it does mean, however, that the approach to the problems is different, and if we can move in this direction, the quality of the outcome will be very, very different than simply a clash and a standoff. Chris Argyris, a guru in management theory, talks about second mode learning, really learning to be able to question underlying assumptions in organizations and change one's actions. Much of what I described as a new prototype of a politician may sound similar to, for example, a social worker in a ghetto, or an adult educator in Latin America, or a manager implementing total quality control in his firm, or a group psychologist in group therapy sessions, or a negotiator in the Bosnian War, or maybe a teacher in a further education college. These activities, or even prototypes, may be seen by most as soft or even on the fringe of the political world. I, however, believe they must become the center of progressive political action. I myself have recently proposed within my party to create both the structures and the activities that will slowly transfer us to an educational party. And this means that we must see a new pedagogy, new political and analytical tools must be developed to cater to this new role of a party. Whether the underlying issues are complexity of the problems, or impotency of our representative democracy, or the weakening of the nation state, and therefore the inability of the politician to wield much power, or new centers of power, such as the media, nevertheless, we need new prototypes to create a politician, or just to create politics as education. I'd like to quote Norberto Bobbio, who saw education resolving the tension between freedom and responsibility. I would add that education, as I have described it, may help resolve the tension between representation and participation, between a more representative democracy and a more participatory democracy. But what would be the goals of politics as education? Norberto Bobbio again would say that the citizen could partake in the most salutary fruits of the European intellectual tradition, that is, the value of inquiry, the ferment of doubt, the willingness to dialogue, the spirit of criticism, moderation of judgment, philological scruple, and a sense of complexity of things. This, of course, takes me to the realm of education per se. And I'd like to finish by talking a bit about education as politics. As ministers of education in my previous post in the European Union and in the OECD, we often tried to predict future developments. Jacques Delors, in a recent speech to the ministers of education and labor in Venice, said that education and training cannot solve the problem of unemployment. Progress advances more quickly than we can follow. In referring to Rifkin and Habermas, he added that no one can deny that at the beginning of the century, a worker devoted 100,000 hours during his or her lifetime to work. Today, this number has decreased to 60,000 hours, and tomorrow it will only be 20,000. But in this virtual world of information and technology, something else will certainly fill in the time. In all honesty, the only sure conclusion we have come to in our meetings is that we really cannot predict tomorrow. How, therefore, does one structure educational systems to cater to citizens who must prepare for the unpredictable? The emerging trends of the 21st century raise new questions on the nature of politics. An essential question that we have to answer is, what does it mean to be a citizen in a post-industrial society? Politics is, above all, participation in civic life. As such, it is inextricably linked with the concept of civic society. Within the context of representative democracy, we tend to consider as politics only the activity of politicians representing the interests of society. Yet in the emerging post-industrial society, the new concerns of the environment, of the equality of women and men, of multiculturalism, of an internationalization of our economies and our labor market, of the quality of life, of the ethical dilemmas of biotechnology, of a knowledge-based production, have provided fertile ground for the reemergence of the concept of civic existence, that is, of citizenship. This concept is based upon the idea of individual responsibility, of active participation, of social solidarity, which manifests itself not on ideology, but on practical action. The widening division within developed society make it imperative that this new concept of active citizenship is strengthened and that it become an instrument for a better, fair, democratic society. The traditional model of doing politics, in which those less able to speak for themselves are merely called upon once every 4 years to elect those that lead and represent them, becomes less and less adequate in order to express the needs of a society far more complex and multifaceted than the traditional industrial society of our century. Citizens need to participate more actively in the management of public interest. Power needs to be devolved while the citizens must become involved, not least in order to validate the democratic process. They need to be informed so as to make sensible choices in a world of ever-increasing complexity. Therefore, as global electronic communication predominates in all spheres of civic existence, there emerges the need for a new type of citizen, an informed, participating, active citizen whose control over the powerful political organization that goes with post-industrial society depends not on mass action, but on knowledge. Access to knowledge and information, then, becomes paramount in this future society. This power is either democratized or usurped into new establishments and oligopolies. This is exactly where the relationship between politics and education comes into play. Active citizens need to be learning citizens, and the acquisition of knowledge and aptitudes related to participation in the political process is a top priority. Politics, the representation of the public interest and the management of organized society, is a problem-solving process. In seeking to develop a learning model for a politician to be, or should I say, a citizen, we may find out that concrete active learning, or learning by doing, is at least as important as abstract or passive learning, the traditional way of education we are used to from school experience. As citizens are required to participate, express opinion, and take action in a variety of causes and issues affecting their life, they will need to learn by a combination of means. They will need to develop both a mental set and a model for action. In this learning approach, practice is as important as theory. Gerald Graff, a professor of humanities and education, believes that the most effective way to deal with the present conflicts is to teach the conflicts themselves. He adds that although this may go against the sacred taboos of pedagogy, it is much less harmful and certainly more useful than the infantilizing effects of conflict evasion. So while I believe that in our times politics needs to be education, so do I believe that our educational system must be political, not partisan, but political. That is, to prepare the future citizen to be able to participate fully in a complex, post-industrial, knowledge-based, but simultaneously democratic society. There is an important convergence here. Post-industrial education must be simultaneously technological, humanistic, and democratic if it is to fully prepare students for our learning society, as a recent European Union Commission white paper calls it. Umberto Eco has said, teaching will change. People will have to learn to think in a critical way. Richard Lanham, in his work, Extraordinary Convergence, believes that the people who developed the personal computer considered it a device of radical democratization from its inception. Digitization of the arts radically democratizes them, and such democratization is a perfect instance of new thinking that society is demanding of the liberal arts. He continues supporting that the most powerful influence of the computer on modern thinking, I would argue, is not statistical or scientific, but it is humanistic. In fact, this is very much what Delors' UNESCO Commission has recommended recently. Learning in today's society must promote, first of all, learning to be in society, to be together in different environments, in teams, to be oneself in a socially cohesive environment. Secondly, to learn throughout one's life, fostering the joy of learning, beginning with an all-important emphasis on preschool learning. Thirdly, learning on the job, in the society, in school or university, creating flexible bridges to and from the world of work to the world of the family or the world of the school. Fourthly, to allow for great diversity in choice and schooling, guaranteeing second chances without creating inequalities. And fifthly, learning to be critical, imaginative, to synthesize, to express, to analyze. This means drastic change in our educational system. They are still geared, our systems, toward an industrial society, which is comparatively rigid, very structured, and quite predictable. On the verge of these changes, we are still trying to understand the challenges ahead of us. Many talk of new doomsdays, others of great opportunities. Whatever the case, if we are able to recreate our political life into a conscious educational project, we can at least guarantee that our societies will be humane. Thank you very much.
Minister, your Founders' Day lecture will be remembered as a challenging contribution to a distinguished line of ministerial speakers at the school. It's easy to recognize in you, though not perhaps in all politicians, the animator, the creator of social capital, as you express the political task. We are now grateful to you, not only for your concrete help, which we celebrate tomorrow, with the opening of the Hellenic Observatory at the school, but for the intellectual stimulus you have offered us this evening. It does not stop there. You have agreed to answer questions.
Being an LSE alumnus, you are surely aware that here at LSE, as well as in other British universities, there is more than double difference in tuition fees for overseas students. Would you qualify as democratic, or rather polarization leading process, the fact that more than a half, I would say, or a vast majority of students at LSE are overseas students, and they come mainly from the third developing countries? Wouldn't it be ironic that those who really are the poorest have to pay most for education? And could you just answer another question, whether there is such a difference in fees in Greece, at Greek universities, and if not, why not, since it seems to work?
Well, that's a very difficult question to answer, and I'll tell you why. When I was at LSE, and there was a hike in the foreign student fees, we took over the LSE. But now, from the point of view of the minister, I see things differently, you see. So, I have to give both sides in trying to be consistent with what I was saying. One really has to look and see. I wouldn't disagree at all that we need to see what is necessary for third world development. However, I wouldn't be able to expect that particularly LSE policies or any particular university's policies could make a major dent in the need for much aid in education to third world. I think this is something that the states, the governments of the more developed world must look at and certainly help. Now, talking about fees, in Greece we have no fees, as you know. However, that costs a lot. It costs those who cannot find a place in the university and must pay by leaving Greece or by finding some other institution somewhere, paying out of their own pocket. So, in fact, when you have a stringent budget, when you have specific sums, if you do want to be, do want to have some social color in your policy, it would be much more useful to say, we will use this money to help those that really need it, really need their help, those that really need to subsidize their tuition or even maybe their room and board, and let the others pay. That would be a much more socialist, I would say, approach, because what we right now have in Greece is we say free tuition for everyone, but it really is not free tuition for everyone. It's free tuition for those who are able to get into the universities, and very many of those who are able to get into the universities are those who are able to pay large sums of money, much more than what tuition would cost in the university, to prepare for the exams. So in fact, what we have here is a very large class difference, where you have people investing to prepare for the exams to then get free education, while others who do not have the money to invest in education must then go on either in not getting education or in paying for their own way in some private institution in Greece or outside Greece. So I'm not sure if I answered your question, but I tried to illuminate it.
Do you not think that the media are working against everything that you've been advocating this evening? I feel that when I graduated in this school 50 years ago, people were more conscious of the importance of what you've just been outlining, and people were more anxious to know the causes of things than they are now. The media are working against you. They don't want people to know the reasons why things happen. They tend to trivialize everything. And the television and the popular press are the worst offenders in that respect. Would you agree with that?
I'd agree in many instances. I wouldn't want to make a blank statement which would cover all media. I think there is an important contribution media is making to developing democracy, but there is also, and I would agree with you on that, that a very much a tendency, first of all, for media to become more and more controlled by fewer and fewer, and therefore there is a question of how democratically controlled these huge conglomerates of information creation democratically they're being governed, and how much the average citizen has a say in this world of media. Secondly, most private media look at ratings and do not look at content other than ratings. And that very often demeans any real critical approach to the type of media, the type of information they give. It's much more an attempt to create an emotion, an attempt to create a reaction, an attempt to draw in the viewer, to glue the viewer onto the television, rather than actually to create some form of thinking, deeper thinking, for the viewer. And I just wanted to mention here that it is very peculiar that when we talk about areas like Bosnia, we are much more willing to send in troops and much less willing to create institutions using this technology, international organizations using this technology, which could set up the type of media which would allow for a much more constructive debate of the differences of the different sides that are involved in this type of a conflict. And because we have not been able to do this, what we see is the other extreme. Very often media is there in order to create ethnic hatred or animosity between the different sides, and uses that to create greater strength in a particular sector of the population. So I think there are some very important questions that our society has to ask itself about media and the future of media if we want to talk about a democratic society.
At the beginning of your lecture, I think you observed very correctly that democracy cannot be legislated or imposed from above. I was wondering whether this observation is consistent with your model of the politician as educator who creates social capital. In other words, I was wondering if the technological, humanistic, and democratic education that you advocate as being pertinent for the post-industrial citizen, it cannot be imposed from above, then how can it be actually carried out?
Well, I think that's one of the questions where you have to say what came first, the chicken or the egg. I think that there's obviously a dialectic there. Certainly there will be those, or this is my hope, there will be those that those politicians and those citizens, those parties that will act in this direction and create prerequisites for developing this social capital. We do have parties, and there are parties that have major educational activities. For example, the Scandinavian parties, and particularly the Social Democratic parties, do have a tradition of education being part of their political activity. However, what I'm saying is not that the politician be educated, but that the politician be educated also, that he is part of this process. I don't say that the institutions don't matter; they definitely do matter. But if they are devoid of social capital or the cultural aspect of democracy, then they are just a mute letter. So I think we need to see this in a dialectical perspective.
Coming back to the recent elections that happened in Greece, I have a question. I remember your party leader referring to one particular motto called modernization, and in several spectrums. And I was wondering, what are your views concerning modernization of the state in Greece, and specifically how you're going to adjust theory into action? How you're going to transform theory into practice? Thank you.
Well, that's lecture number two now. Well, it's a difficult, it's a very long, needed a very long answer if I were to be able to answer this. But we are in dire need of some major changes in our state bureaucracy in Greece, and creating the type of values and the type of management, the type of workings which will allow for the services, the public services, to be to cater to the needs of the citizen in an efficient way, but also to get beyond a concept that has lingered with us for many years, that of clientelism, torusfeti, as we say, anaxiokratia, or the absence of meritocracy. These are remnants of a time where basically the state was there to buy off voters through a clientelistic system. And this is why much of the many of our problems, the bloated state and also the inefficiency of the state, exists. So these are things we have to tackle. And this will be done through a number of measures, certainly through education and training within the public sector, certainly through reorganization, decentralization of the services, and possibly completely new revamping of some of the services also.
Coming back to this communication process between the politician and the citizen, I would like you to be a little bit more specific about the concrete tools of this communication process, and actually asking you to give a personal example. During the election period in Greece, we had the opportunity to watch one of your days on television where I saw that you had the opportunity to meet hundreds of people in one day. And I kept wondering, did that help in any way to get to actually to understand people's problems? Is that part of the process you were talking about? Or could you suggest some channels of communication, actually effective channels of communication, that would contribute to this education of the politician, if there can be such an education, because it's a matter of the mentality also, and I'm afraid about, well, how effective that would be. Thank you.
Well, just to say something about the politician, I think that many realize, although it may not be an easy realization, that the types of problems that we're facing simply can't be solved through some simple gesture or some phone call or some kind of a simple plan and a blueprint. And that you really need, first of all, because the types of problems very often are very much value, the solutions to the problems have very much a value on them. For example, when we're talking about environment, well, what type of environment one wants is something which a politician himself or herself cannot alone make a decision. This is something where those who will be living in the environment must have much more of a say. So creating a common value or creating a consensus around an issue is very important. Now, during election time, it is true that one has very little time, and it's not the best of examples of real communication or real understanding. That doesn't mean that there isn't communication. There is communication within that small framework of the small time span that one has. However, what I'm proposing is, in fact, that we do not see this relationship as once a 4-year relationship, but that this is an ongoing relationship using the types of means that we may have at our disposal. Going to a Scandinavian model, I just wanted to give you an example. I remember when there was a referendum on nuclear energy. They decided to publish a book, and then study circles were created throughout Sweden where whoever wanted to, not only members of the party, but whoever wanted to could get involved, discuss the issue, find out about the issue, and propose, and also finally decide in the referendum. Another way which I think will be of great use is the use of internet. This is something which we have tried in Greece in the Ministry of Education for the last few months. We have had something like 350,000 accesses only the last few months, which is a very large number for Greece, which shows that there are other means that can be used to create an interactive relationship between the politician and the citizen. But I wouldn't want to see it only between the politician and the citizen. It could be between the citizen and the citizen also. And this is the type of networking which we need to develop. But there are certainly new areas to be looked into in this area.
You mentioned actually the fundamental principle about freedom with responsibility. Do you think that media in Greece fulfill that fundamental principle? Because we know that media is part of our general education system, and you have it in our home, who want it or not. I'd like to comment on that. Or they confuse freedom with anarchy or chaos. Thank you.
Well, you may know or you may not that I was one of the proponents in 1986, I think it was, of free radio in Greece, when at that time only state-controlled radio and television existed. What I did say then, of course, is that that does not mean that anybody who wants to just opens up a radio station and starts broadcasting, but that there be specific rules and specific norms developed which will foster both a pluralistic expression of all the different types of views and also a responsibility to the viewer, to the listener. Unluckily, we had, this has happened a number of times in a number of areas in Greece, whether it's the Aftereta, whether it's the Kendra Eleftheron Spudon or whatever, as like the free radio, you get a spontaneous movement before the government or the state or the or society at large decides to regulate this type of an action or this type of an activity. And therefore, when you come to regulate it, the situation is already created. So what we had is when regulation came for free radio and then later on for television, we already had television stations all over Greece, which had created a tradition of the types of rules or the types of norms that they were to follow. So it's very difficult to legislate against that. But I agree that at this point we need to slowly but surely create a the type of regulation which will foster more responsibility and more pluralism in the area of radio and television.
Thank you. Is there a microphone?
Please.
You expressed a belief in meritocracy. How then do you justify the decision to give almost 4,000 university places to students in Greece who hadn't met the entrance criteria right in the run-up to the general election? Wasn't this an attempt to gain their votes rather than meritocracy?
Well, actually, it was absolutely meritocratic because they got in on their own on the results of their tests. It was not as if they were given these positions because they had not done well. The problem in Greece, as I said earlier, is the number of positions we have. We have a numerous clauses, as we call it, that is a closed number of positions. And the demand for education is much higher than the number of positions we can give. That does not mean that the students who do not get a good grade, that do not get a position in the university are not good students. Let me give you an example of a more simpler example of our system compared to, let's say, another system. If you have 10 people that are racing together, let's say 100 meters race, if you simply put them in the order they finish the 100 meter race, you get the first and you get the 10th. And if you say, I'll take five, you say you take five people. That's what we do in Greece. On the other hand, if you timed them and you said, what is their time? You might say that everybody who is under 10 seconds or under 12 seconds will take. And you might have eight people or you might have all 10 people. So in fact, we are not testing their ability. We're just testing if they are better in competition with somebody that's next to them. So what I simply said is we have to open up our universities, give more positions, because these students are able students. And the proof is in the pudding here at LSE. There are many students that didn't make it, or maybe of them did make it and wanted to come to LSE, or others that didn't want to take the exams at all. But there are many students outside Greece that are doing very well, and that just didn't happen to make it in these exams in Greece. So I would say that this is certainly meritocratic.
We have time for just one more question, I fear.
Thank you. I wonder in your post-industrial society there will still be need for people to eat, so you will need farmers and skilled artisans. Even internet producers. These people may they not be content simply to ply their trade, not be really interested in much else, see their fulfillment in that activity and in nothing else, and look to the politicians simply to set the conditions for them, which will allow them just to do that, and not be too much interested in anything else. Now, will they be excluded or will they be obliged to get the sort of formal education you enjoy here, or are you hoping for some osmotic process which will lead to their conversion to fully qualified, democratized citizens?
Well, I certainly wouldn't like to portray an image of forcing people to become democratic, or forcing education on them. However, I do believe that the type of situation we are, our societies are moving into, is one where blissful isolation, which sometimes I often dream of too, is just really difficult to find. The farmer, I'm not saying that you won't have farmers that might be able to just live off their land, but more and more, it'll be much more difficult to avoid the types of issues which will be infringing on this isolation, whether it's environmental problems, whether it's the fact that your produce is being sold on an international market which fluctuates all over the place. We are being forced to integrate into this world society. I'm not saying that that's necessarily good, but that's what reality is. In doing so, at least what I feel we have as a responsibility to our citizens is to prepare them the best we can to be able to fare in a very competitive and a very difficult, maybe with many opportunities, but maybe with many difficulties also, international society. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Minister, I think you can tell from the number of hands which would still like to go up how interesting your talk has been found. I hope it's clear to you also how much we've enjoyed having you back with us at the school. When we move out, it would be very helpful if the audience would just hesitate a moment before getting up so I can take the guests out. But thank you very much indeed.